today, a guest so special that she deserves her own intro music. Actually, thanks to my friend and former student, Ubby, we have new intro music on the podcast. For a guest today, I'm interviewing Rebecca Cardone, student body president at California Lutheran University, outgoing senior, and one of my allies in the interfaith movement here. We talk about faith journeys, the National Day of Prayer breakfast that we recently attended, and the future of faith in America. Enjoy. How long have you been involved with the interfaith movement yourself?
I was first introduced to it my sophomore year of high school, so that was about 6 years ago. Yeah. And I had...
In Texas.
I was at a... I was in Mexico on a mission trip.
All right.
And it was just a few miles from the border. I was at an orphanage, and I remember having a conversation with one of the youth pastors. It's like, well, how do I be strong in my Christian faith and not be, not allow that sentiment to be rude to my dad, who's Jewish? Huh. And now, again, my memory may be flawed because it's been a while and I was quite a bit younger, but this is what stuck with me and kind of driven me. And the youth pastor had said, oh, your dad's Jewish. Well, let's set up a meeting with him when we get back, and we can maybe talk to him about converting to Christianity. And so I was like, well, that was not my intent of the question. That's not what I want to do. It was really a shock for me because interfaith had always been a part of our family.
Interfaith, you come from an interfaith family, right? I think your mother is Christian.
My mom's Christian. She didn't
non-denominational kind of?
Not so much. She's, I was baptized Methodist, and so Methodist was a church that we had identified with when I was growing up, but I don't think that she was raised with a particular denomination when she was growing up.
Yeah.
But yes, and so my brothers and I have each developed our own perspective on religion. So interfaith family, it was never really an issue. And so that one moment on that mission trip made me realize I needed to find some sources. I was going into my AP language class, and I wanted to write a paper on interfaith.
So you got into it through a paper, an academic paper in high school.
Yes, and so I found Eboo Patel's book, and actually it was one of his more academic texts on building the interfaith youth movement and what that might look like. And then somehow interfaith had gotten away from me for a while. I remember mentioning it when I came to interview at Cal Lutheran, and that being even a fairly emotional moment for me when I realized that Cal would accept it. My tour guide was Jewish. I'd spoken with the dean of students and one of the psychology professors in my interview about it. And so then that was the start. That was over 4 years ago for me of my interfaith work at CLU.
And so you've had a really interesting faith journey. I mean, you're an interfaith activist here, but personally, you come from an interesting, unique, religious hybrid background in your family, and then coming here to a Lutheran university. Mm-hmm. How did your faith journey unfold here?
Yeah, so coming to CLU, the first question people ask is, "Well, are you Lutheran?"
Really? Is that a common question?
For me, they do. And so,
because not even a majority of people here are.
No, so, I'm not sure. It's maybe about a fifth.
Is that a way that people kind of feel each other out? Like, why are you here?
Perhaps, yeah. But it's not always the people at CLU ask if I'm Lutheran, but definitely the people back home.
Why are you affiliated with this institution?
Yeah, how'd you find Cal Lutheran?
Right, you must be Lutheran. Oh, okay, yeah.
Yes, so.
But that's not the reality on the ground here.
Right, no, right. It's not. And here it's... We are very sensitive to what... I feel like that we are very sensitive as a community to what people believe, and we allow that conversation to evolve. But it's also a comfortable question to ask somebody what faith tradition they come from.
Yeah.
Which is great. I think it's to allow that identity to not be oppressed is also very healthy for interfaith work. Yes, people ask me, are you Lutheran? I say, no, well, what are you? I don't know. I try to avoid the question. I had been involved with the Secular Student Alliance. I wasn't completely comfortable with the term atheist because to me it was linguistically a deconstructive term. It's saying you're not theistic.
Right.
And
it's not very positive. Yeah.
Right. It doesn't say anything about the person, in my opinion.
Well, Selena, how did you get involved with the Secular Students Alliance? Was that just... coming up when you were a freshman?
I think it was founded the year before me.
Because it was founded on the Prop 8 stuff here at CLU, right?
I think so, yeah. The
Proposition 8, same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm. So that wasn't, it was the same group of students involved in all that, but that wasn't the topic of our conversations as much. And that might have been one of the day's topics, because the Secular Student Alliance meets every Sunday evening to talk about life's big questions and philosophy and how religion impacts our lives, even though some of the students may not be religious. But so I ran into Evan Clark, the founder of Secular Student Alliance and the current chair of the Secular Student Alliance nationally.
Is he really?
Mm-hmm.
Evan Clark?
Yep, yep. I think he's up for re-election right now, too.
No kidding.
But
good job, Evan.
Yeah. I had asked him, oh, do interfaith work? And because they attend different religious communities and do different religious site visits.
Yeah, I think that's awesome.
Oh, it's great. I think it's a model that other SSAs can use as well for better understanding of others, as well as for the other communities to accept the non-religious community.
Yeah.
So I kind of use that avenue more to learn about more religions and to have those big questions without being in a judgmental environment to ask, you know, what do you believe and why? What's your perspective on the afterlife? What's how would you treat religion with your family when you start building your own family?
Oh, so, these are things that you guys talked about on Sunday night meeting?
Yeah, absolutely. It's wow. So they last 2 hours and we'd have to pull each other away for homework.
That's awesome. Because you don't see, I mean, there's not a lot of groups where you see people just engaging to the level that it's hard to go back to everything else. It seems like sometimes quote-unquote extracurriculars are things that people do on top of what they're already doing as a kind of an extra thing, and then they go back to what they really want to do. But it seems like you really found a community.
It is, and the SSA provides that. And a lot of critiques of the secular student or the secular community is that there is no community, but at Cal Lutheran, that wasn't the issue. Yeah. And in fact, the founder, Evan Clark, went and started his own chapter of the humanist community of Ventura County.
Yeah.
So there are, and that brings back to humanism. In regards to my own faith journey, I did appreciate the term humanism because it gave me something to build with, the belief that humans are capable of improving the lives for each other here on Earth, and so working with that. But I wasn't completely comfortable with only secular humanists or religious humanists, but I did like the term interfaith humanist.
Whoa.
So
Interfaith humanist.
And it's I wouldn't say that I created a religion, absolutely not.
Is that a term you've heard, or
I have not heard combined that. It.
So you did create a religion,
but I don't want people to follow me. It's just for me,
okay.
Personally, but so I ran into Chris Stedman. Chris Stedman is the author of Faithiest: How an Atheist Found How an Atheist Found Common Ground with a Religious.
Yeah. And we had him here on campus before the book came out.
Exactly. So I had helped coordinate his visit when he was with the Harvard Humanist Community, or Chaplaincy, now it's a Harvard Humanist Community. Hmm. So I had him come speak, and he had coined the term faithiest.
Yeah, that's
and,
a cool term too.
So it's a great combination of words to help a personal identity, but also to communicate a message. And so I now use the term interfaith humanist, and that was when I first started identifying with it, and then since then, a little over a year ago, I've become more comfortable with it.
So is that what you identify as now, you think?
Yeah, that's what when I applied to some of the universities and they'd ask me, just for survey, what your religious affiliation is, I would type in other interfaith humanist.
Wow.
And actually, Claremont Lincoln University is really unique in that if the other box did not have a limit on the characters, and sometimes they asked you to explain your religious identity. And
so Claremont Lincoln, for people who don't know, is a brand new university going under accreditation right now, but I guess the world's, they claim to be world's first interreligious.
Mm-hmm. Very interreligious.
So it makes sense that they have a big other category.
Exactly. It's big other category, and you can check many boxes under religious affiliation as well.
Yeah. Now, so, I remember, at some point, did you dabble in Baha'i faith?
A little bit, yeah. It's around the same time, last spring, I had started studying the Baha'i faith through a class, informal class, met in a couple people's homes on the science of spirituality with the scholar Tom Price, and he does a lot of music, I believe, maybe some psychology, I can't remember, it's been a while, but Definitely the science of spirituality, and I've been taking notes, and it started as just a curiosity because I had been to Israel and to the Baha'i Gardens, and I was going just more because of curiosity, but I kept going because it was a language that had more religious terms that I was used to, or more religious terms that I would choose for myself, but the ideas were very much consistent with what I would call interfaith humanist.
Okay.
And
so what are some of those ideas for people who don't sure. know? Like what drew you in there?
Some of the main principles are unity, and so both the unity of gender and of the races, of the languages, of the religions. They embrace diversity. It's the second most geographically diverse religion in the world right
wow.
now.
Wow.
And it's growing very fast. One of the metaphors they use is that men and women are two wings of the same bird, and if one is broken, the bird cannot fly.
Mm.
That every person and community in the world, the world is a body, and if you have an infection in one part of the body, say in a finger, the entire body is affected. And so it really talks about the interconnectedness of everything. And some of the language that they use that I wasn't as at the time as comfortable using, that were more spiritual, I had grown to accept as well, because I was in the Faith and Reason class, the religion capstone at CLU, with Dr. Wyndham Hughes, Dr. Streeter, and Dr. Bursley. And I was learning how different languages have been applied to try to convey similar concepts.
Uh-huh.
And so I've been seeing now how language can be layered and interpreted differently, but I've started finding more of the concepts. And then I've applied some of that language that the religious communities use towards the secular movement, and I try to now help bridge the secular and the religious.
That's
by
so
showing
cool.
the similar language.
I find that really interesting, because I think a lot about language too. I mean, there are religious traditions that are really articulate about the ways in which we cannot articulate spiritual truths through language at all, and we're sort of really kind of distanced from them.
Right.
And then to bring language in to bridge religious bridges, religious gaps, is a really interesting phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a way in which you found, how are you playing with language? Like, give me an example. What are you dealing with language?
One very concrete way, I guess I could say, this may not be a direct answer to your question,
what?
But one concrete way is through amending the student body constitution.
Oh, yeah.
And
which you are student body president.
Well, it's May 2nd, so my term ended April 30th.
Get out of here. Wow. You are president emerita.
Emerita. I guess.
I'm how do you pronounce it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever, you're done.
But so, right. At the time, I was the student body president, and so we were discussing what the language of the student preamble, or the preamble to the student constitution, should be, and what religious ideas should be included as a Lutheran university, but as an interfaith student body.
Yeah.
And so this is a continuation of a conversation that Evan Clark, again to mention him, and also our colleague Evan Sandlin, who graduated last year, had started back in 2011, but this was taking the lessons learned from 2011 and applying it in a new movement and a new language.
Because in 2011, there wasn't a success in getting new language for the student constitutions passed, because the old language said something about, we're doing this to further Christian growth?
Correct, yeah.
This constitution exists, quote-unquote, to further Christian growth?
Correct, yeah. That was one of the principles in the preamble to further Christian growth. And the original wording of the amendment was to, instead of to further Christian growth, to further faith and reason, the discussion of faith and reason. And it seemed like a simple amendment. It was coming from the language of the university mission statement
right.
that encourages critical inquiry into matters of faith and reason. But what we had learned through trial and error was that we needed to nuance it a little bit more and be intentionally inclusive and pinpoint a few more specifics with our language. And so the original amendment had polarized the university committee at community, it felt like. So going back to the National Prayer, or referring back to the National Day of Prayer discussion, there were those who retreated more into, no, absolutely, we are Lutheran, this is Lutheran, we are intended to further Christian growth, for that phrase.
Right.
And so it was really an exclusively Christian meaning. And then there are those who interpreted it as Christian growth includes hospitality, and mm-hmm. We are able to embrace different students from different religions and backgrounds and different people in our community because we're Lutheran University. And so the initial reaction was really polarizing and made it difficult to have a healthy discussion around it. Mm-hmm. But it did plant the seeds in our minds as to what religion could look like at CLU as an institution. So 2013, our new wording that did pass, it passed in the Student Senate as well as by a full student body vote. So instead of to further Christian growth, it is now to inspire the maturity of faith and reason in an environment of Lutheran tradition.
So you were able to kind of appease a lot of people there in that sense, but was appeasement the first primary thing that you were trying to do there?
It wasn't. It was less accommodation and more trying to understand.
Yeah.
And because if we don't accept it as a university, it's not going to have strong enough roots to be sustainable.
Yes.
And so we added the environment of Lutheran tradition portion because we are a Lutheran institution of higher education. Martin Luther was very adamant about the pursuit of higher education and. So we wanted that to be our to maintain our middle name, really.
Yeah.
Our Cal Lutheran middle name.
You found value in that, even though necessarily, personally, you're not, ascribing to that dogma.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm not Lutheran, but I have grown in my time at CLU in the past 4 years to really love and appreciate the Lutheran identity. Mm-hmm. And as a part of my interfaith humanist studies and actions, I could say that Lutheran has become a part of that as well. Absolutely.
Interesting.
A lot of it comes from our work with the Interfaith Allies at CLU that has grown out of the polarization from 2011 with a very concrete purpose and the intent for movement through understanding our Lutheran identity as an institution and our diverse identity as a community.
Yeah. Now, there was also a time in your faith journey where you were actually headlined, and I think it was a USA Today kind of.
Yes. It was USA Today.
You're probably sick of talking about this, but the people want to hear. So, you were headlined in a USA Today article, mm-hmm. and the terminology they used wasn't as respectful as I think you wanted it to mm-hmm. be. But what was the article about?
The article was titled something along the lines of the political emergence of the nuns.
The rise of the nuns.
N-O-N-E-S.
Yeah.
And
not flying nuns. No, the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. The people without religious mm-hmm. affiliation, is that what they were trying
exactly.
to say?
Were they religiously unaffiliated?
Yeah.
Or not affiliated in general. Some of us aren't religious. And so it was a response to the Pew Research data that says that the nuns are growing as a population. And I was contacted by the National Secular Student Alliance to be someone they could refer the journalist to. Mm. And I had typed up all of this, a whole paragraph of what I really wanted to convey, and she used none of it. And so
No pun intended.
Right, the front page of the USA Today with a picture that is not me starts off with Rebecca Cardone, from Katy, Texas, raised Methodist, president of the student body at California Lutheran University, is something like one of the nuns. And I haven't read it in a while, but it used the phrase that I believe in nothing in particular, and it had nothing in particular in quotes. Which I don't think is a... I think that's a very harsh generalization for the religiously unaffiliated. And because it's not that we believe nothing in particular. If you mean that the group is nothing in particular, sure. But to label that individual as believing in nothing is very dehumanizing. And to call us nothing is even more so dehumanizing. Mm. And later in the article, it does highlight that I said I believe in compassion, which is one of the things, and which is fine. But again, goes back to the polarization and the reaction of people. They don't see that when the phrase nothing in particular is attached to my religious identity. And so that, experiencing that and having to deal with phone calls from people I love who felt hurt by the article, some of them before I even saw the article myself.
Oh my God.
It was frustrating, but it also made me articulate what I believe and why. And then going back to pulling some of the religious language that they use for themselves and showing metaphorically how I believe very similar things, just from a different perspective.
So this issue of nuns, though, and going back to the National Day of Prayer breakfast that we were at this morning, it was a very Christian event, a certain kind of Christian. There was one Jewish speaker, and that was it in terms of diversity. Mm-hmm. In the future, I could imagine that maybe they'll have more, I don't know, Muslims up there. Maybe eventually they'll ask a Sikh or a Hindu or, you know, one of those exotic religions to enter the fray. But do you think a body like that, a group of people like that, can accommodate faith-theists, can accommodate humanists? I mean, what is that going to look like?
Well, it did not happen, for example, at one of the interfaith memorial services that President Obama was at for the victims of the Boston bombings.
Right. They had a couple Christian, including a Catholic person and a Muslim person. Mm-hmm.
So the emphasis of the National Day of Prayer today was on a lot of the prayer aspects and some of the stories. But one of the speaker actually had interpreted some of the prayer aspect through the phrase rise and shine, one of the things that we hear in our mornings. But he interpreted shine as through the engagement with the divine. In prayer, we can be a reflection of God's work in the world, and we can do that work. Mm. And so a faith-theist or a humanist or a secular student or a secular person or atheist might then interpret that language and say, okay, we're reflecting on this, we're praying, we are moving into action.
Okay.
We are being the reflection of each other's humanity and preserving the dignity of each other, and we are doing good in the world, because how else are we going to move forward? We are going to shine as a rising population. We are not going to allow the next awakening to be, as the speaker had said, a rude awakening. It's going to be a great awakening. And
so this speaker seemed to be coming from an evangelical Christian background, but you're interpreting him and giving quite a bit of charity. And I think to some extent, you know, he did purposely try to leave a lot of room for openness and was somewhat welcoming. But you're saying, I want to take that openness and I want to include myself in the conversation. That's really hopeful and optimistic. So. The language, then, about shine is not necessarily, okay, metaphysical divine grace. It's, for you, it can be a human shining. That's where you can plug into the prayer breakfast.
Exactly. They mentioned repeatedly that people who, while some ran away from the bombings, even more the first responders.
The bombings in Boston recently, the marathon?
The Boston bombings.
Yeah.
That people ran towards it and were helping the people, sacrificing themselves. And that's a lot about with public service, too, going back to the national aspect of the day of prayer and praying for the government officials. And so the part of the shine, again, is doing the actions. And so it does... It translates. It's, but it does take a little bit of extra work when we're in these events and meetings, and we hear the language on the surface level. But instead of reacting to it, you have to process it, interpret it, and apply it to yourself, how you would personally identify with it. Now, in an interfaith, a more interfaith type of event in 2033, I would like to hope that language becomes the surface level as well. And maybe that will provide for even deeper concerted action and harmony more so than on the individual interpretation level.
Now, I would imagine that some religious people there, some people who don't accommodate right now, but in some sense also feel that they are being forced to accommodate because of the rise of secularism, whether it be real or imagined, they feel that they might, I feel like some of the people who are worshiping with us there this morning, eating with us there this morning, might feel that they are being asked now to further accommodate. Is there a way in which there can be room on both ends then for, I mean, what language can we, like, how do we use language, right? And people can still talk about God, and people can still talk about Christ, or people can still talk about Deuteronomy and passing tradition onto your children in in one of these kind of Jewish ways. And then also we can have people of humanist backgrounds or atheist backgrounds in the conversation.
Yeah, some of it comes from what I was exposed to through Dr. Wyndham Hughes' classes, including how John Hick and Immanuel Kant interpret reality. Mm-hmm. So there's reality as it is and reality as it's experienced.
Yeah.
And so reality as it is that which is real.
Right.
But as experience can have an infinite number of interpretations and perspectives, but it needs the diversity of perspectives to shed a little bit of light on what reality actually is.
I see.
And so you're
saying, like, at the epistemological level,
exactly,
there's room there for us to own a broader public sphere.
Exactly.
Wow.
So that would just mean, rather than necessarily changing the language of the people who are there, adding another voice.
Okay.
And now it may get to the point where you have this massive parliament of religions with infinite membership, but just a couple more people, and even if it's if it changes year to year, who's which I don't want to say who's invited to the table, because defining who's invited to the table is almost counterproductive, but being more open and more aware of that diversity to allow those voices to be present, and not necessarily changing the individual languages used or the specific traditions languages used, but recognizing that there's more languages as well.
I'm really interested in how this is going to play out in court cases and stuff like that. Not only in terms of people without religious affiliation, but people with sort of hybrid identities, right? I mean, conceivably there's a lot of, I don't know, Buddhist Sikhs out there or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Who want to take some aspects of these ethics and then want to do that. And then what happens when it comes to First Amendment issues or freedom of speech issues? I mean, that's something that our assumptions about religion, which, you know, assume that everyone has one and only one, right? If anything, none, but not two.
Right, and people are almost discredited if they accept multiple religions or multiple identities or multiple philosophies, and they're degraded as cherry-picking what they want to believe and muddying the word of God by taking out pieces from the whole.
But in my conversation with the students that I have, like yourself, some of these people come from households in which there's multiple religions at the dinner table,
right?
Like Thanksgiving is an interfaith event, right?
Oh my gosh, there's at least five in my family.
And then there's sort of, you know, what some people call, whether fairly or not, sort of cafeteria style religion, but that is a part of culture today. I mean, it's there. So I'm interested to see how that kind of plays out, because I don't know if the Constitution, as we interpret it in a majoritarian way right now, is ready for hybrid religious identity.
Right.
But you seem like an optimist. You seem like somebody who feels like this is going to work out just fine. We got to do a little bit of extra work.
Yeah, one thing that I struggle with, though, is I am very much individualistic. And so I would interpret the Constitution more as freedom of conscience, or liberty with the freedom of conscience. But I see that on a very individual level. My passion really is human rights on the global scale.
Okay.
And so coming into the conversation from a Western perspective, I am also identified as individualist versus some do juxtapose that with the more community-oriented ideas of conscience in other regions of the world. And so if the Constitution is trying to be a an executable format for human rights promulgation and preserving of human dignity, then that I do see that that need to be reflected as well. So personally, I don't see, I see multiple identities as becoming stronger, but I'm still trying to figure out the rest of it.
I think we're all going to be, but tell me this, how many more days till graduation?
16.
But who's counting?
Right.
So I'm not going to ask you what you're going to do when you graduate, but I am going to ask you, because that's a terrible question, right? That's the, everyone's asking you that question right now. I am going to ask something different, or the same question in a different way.
Different language.
I mean, so human rights, that's a passion of yours. What do you want to do? Where do you want to take it? What is your dream of Rebecca Cardone 2023?
Right. So I do love academics and research in theory, but I also love applying that and doing something with it.
Yep.
So I am trying my best to be patient, which I do not... patience is something I do not have.
But, me too.
So my master's for next year will focus around the empowerment of Persian Baha'i women in diaspora and how they've worked in overcoming structural marginalizations and structural violence themselves, and how they've worked in social justice transnationally and helping others who may not have the privileges to overcome their marginalizations to empower them really with their own resources in improving society as a whole.
So you're already speaking academic talk, so you got that down.
So
say it in English.
So, well,
Baha'i women who are not living in their home country, or the Baha'i home country of Iran.
Yes.
Right? How these women are using religion to uplift others who are not.
And not really? Just religion in a missionary sense, but how they'll found organizations that are based in Baha'i principles, but they apply them secularly, and they don't restrict their target populations by religious identity.
So they're enacting faith, but not necessarily for the end of faith or in faith expression.
Exactly. It's for the betterment of humanity here.
Yeah.
And so part of the Baha'i faith is... So the five senses for human beings are really cultivated and nurtured in the womb of the mother for the baby. When the baby is born into this world, a Tom Price scholar that I had studied under for the science of spirituality, he used the metaphor that in this world, we are supposed to be cultivating good values and what good is it looks like. And he does define a few of them for the sake of the conversation, but they are a very there's a plurality of these values, and they come in different proportions. But to work on that, because those are the principles and the values that we can take into the next world.
Yeah.
And regardless of what that world might look like. And so...
But this world we're cultivating.
Exactly. This world is what we have to work with.
That's beautiful.
And so it does have a very... a sense of immediacy to it. It doesn't allow you to wait. And so how the Baha'i women have overcome their marginalization in Iran through the immigration process... right now, my research is limited to the United States because I'm here right now.
Yeah.
But these women do work in all over the world from their homes in Los Angeles, in Houston, and Maryland. And so so I'm interviewing them, in the process of interviewing them right now.
Okay.
Write my master's dissertation on it, and then my hopefully my PhD thesis will be very comparative. I have countries right now for Turkey, Iran, Israel, and the Palestine territories, and a little bit of Armenia.
Wow, so you want to broaden from master's to PhD. Yes. Why don't you get a bachelor's first? You got a couple of weeks to get that.
Oh, I kind of already have.
Do you?
I could have graduated last spring.
Oh, okay. So you're just here for fun.
I'm just hanging out.
So where is this master's going to get done that year?
It'll be at Oxford University in England.
I heard of that little place.
Yeah. So I'll be a member of Exeter College there. Just a one-year master's, so it'll be very intense. But
you're getting started on it through the interview, so you've done some of the groundwork, qualitative research there.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, it's so impressive, Rebecca.
But,
well, I mean, I wish you the best of luck. I can't wait to read your dissertation if you let me.
Sure, I have to rate it first. Yeah. It's going to be a long journey to get to that
But you're like me, you've already planned out all these other steps, so I look forward to watching your career, and I know the world's going to be a better place for your work.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on an awesome CLU career.
Thank you.
All right.